Going to go through the formalities of calling this meeting to order and so on, suggest that, and then we'll do the formal. Please, have a seat right here.
No, right here, okay.
Those, all three of them are pretty hot, so you get to choose what hot seat you want to sit on.
All right.
Yeah, very good. Well, we want to extend a welcome. Today is August 9th, 2023, and it is now 3:30 p.m. And it is an honor to call to the Santa Maria County Board of County Commissioners work session to order. We have a very special guest today with us. So having said that, please rise for an invocation by Commissioner Luis Lopez, and we're going to do the Pledge of Allegiance by Commissioner Tony Haas.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for keeping our firefighters safe in our recent fire out of Kim, Colorado, as of yesterday. We thank you for being an opportunity to serve you, Lord, and coming together and meeting your name. In your holy name, Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Commissioner Tony, please lead us on a Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all. Welcome, Mr. Durham.
Commissioner Haas. Commissioner Haas.
Here.
Commissioner Luis Lopez.
I'm right here.
Commissioner Luis Lopez.
Here. Approval of the agenda. Any changes, Mr. Durham?
No changes, Commissioner.
I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Move for approval of the agenda.
Second.
Commissioner Luis Lopez?
Yes.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes, and so thank you so much. We welcome our state treasurer, Mr. Dave Young. Thank you for doing the rounds throughout the state of Colorado. Welcome to Los Angeles County. The
best county, don't forget.
The best county in the state of Colorado. And the conversation, we had an opportunity to meet with them and Treasurer Leonetti a few minutes ago. And what I extended to them was some information that if you want to go to New York, but you don't really feel like going there, you can travel 1,500 or 1,600 miles within the county without having to even go outside of the border. So welcome to you. And would you please do some introductions?
I'm wondering,
I think
on?
You're wrong.
Is it yellow?
Am I on here? Can you hear me?
It's orange, it's on.
If this works,
yep. Yes.
All right. So I'm Dave Young. I'm the Colorado State Treasurer. With me today is Shuna Kani, who is the communications director for the Treasury as well. And so we appreciate you carving out some time out of your busy schedules to give us a little time to talk about the work we do in the Treasury. I also want to just let you know that we're here to listen as well. So I get pretty wound up about my, as you all know from the previous meetings, programs we do, but I want to be sure that we have enough time to hear from all of you as well. Any concerns or things you want us to know, this is a chance for me to hear.
Well, on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners in San Luis County and all of those of us elected here in this county, we extend to you a sincere welcome. And the information that you have for us, one of the things that I, many years ago, I heard a commercial that the state treasurer can fill the Denver Broncos Stadium with the money, the excess money that you have. Is that still the case today?
Are you talking about the Great Colorado Payback?
Yes, sir.
I would say probably more. We're holding over $1 billion of unclaimed property in the state treasury. Most of that is cash. About 0.2% of it is actually tangible objects that are in safety deposit boxes that banks transmit to us. By volume, it's pretty big. It fills our safe, and we were just looking at Treasurer Leonetti's safe in there, that huge one, and we were pretty envious because we have need for a safe that size to house all of our tangibles. But yeah, over $1 billion that we're anxious to get back to people who have got separated from their money. So I don't know if you looked at your the Great Colorado Payback and checked to see if you have any.
I'm sure I do. I'll be calling.
All right, well, you go online. The address is the longest one. I didn't dream this up, but it's colorado.findyourunclaimedproperty.com. It's a pretty long address to put in. I was president of all unclaimed property programs around the world 2 years ago, And we've developed a website called missingmoney.com, which we're in the process of converting over to missingmoney.gov to add a little bit more credibility so people are a little more confident going there. But there's a map, and you can actually click into Colorado and get to our program here in the state of Colorado. But if you've lived in other states or other countries, you can use the map to actually go and check out the programs in these other states. And I encourage people to do that because people move around. I encourage them to do that for their friends, their family, and their work colleagues. It's also businesses. So we have businesses that have unclaimed property. School districts have unclaimed property. Counties do. So yeah, we're really trying to get this back to people.
So a couple of years ago, I made sure seen some advertisements on some television commercials for them.
Yeah.
And radio ads and stuff like that. And having conversations in the multiple businesses that I operate. The conversation that I have with customers and tenants and so forth regarding that is they think it is a way to get caught for not paying their taxes or criminal activity or deadbeat dads and moms, child support services. So how do we overcome that through your PIO officer there and get the word out that it's not that?
Yeah.
Any suggestions?
Well, I mean, we have to do our due diligence. I think probably the thing that we hear most often is people are a little skeptical because they don't want to. We ask for some identifying information like social security number, and people are rightfully, nervous about submitting that kind of information, but we have to have a way to identify. We're not trying to scam people or somehow do a workaround with other parts of government. We're legitimately just trying to get this money back to people.
So is there a statute of limitations of how long the Treasurer's Office holds on to that?
It's a trust fund, it's in perpetuity. So we'll hold it forever. Now, some of the tangibles that don't have a lot of value, we will put on an auction, but we have tangibles that may not have a lot of value, like a war medal, Purple Heart, or something like that. So if we auctioned that, it would not yield much, but we know it has sentimental value to the family. And so we hold on to a lot of those tangibles just because we know, in fact, that we have more value personally. In fact, Sheena has actually looked for you, Commissioner Lopez.
Found me?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of us. There's a lot of
three. Louis A. Lopez II.
Yeah.
Looks like you did not get a tax return check.
Oh, really?
You've got a few hundred dollars there.
Don't spend it all in this
file. I'll call my accountant to see why. Probably because of my billion or mailing address and business address.
Right.
So on that money, and I love money, and I love playing with other people's money, are we able at your office, similar to what we can at Donald's office very carefully, is invest that into, especially with the Fed's interest rates being so high now, into those good accounts to get that interest bearing back and build that fund balance? And then what do you do with that that yield that comes from that?
Right. Well, we actually have several different pools that we invest in. Certainly, the Unclaimed Property Fund is one of those that we invest. The legislature has decided that they want to use those returns to enhance agriculture in the state of Colorado, and some of that money goes to the state fair and to other agriculture activities. And so that's what the returns for that particular fund do. The main T-pool that we invest, that just goes back, the earnings we get on that goes back to supplement the general fund. But I also manage a public school fund investment board, and that money stays within that fund as well. So
the reason why I asked is because yesterday we just had budget review for all of our elected official offices.
Our fun time was that budget. Yeah.
And commissioners always trying to find more money to help out these offices. In particular, yesterday there was some concerns of different offices that are only funded by county. Let's say, for instance, the coroner's office, where the majority of in our small community that's happened in Los Angeles, in the city of Trinidad. But versus the county has to pay all the expenditures, there are ways to maneuver some funds for those other types of small counties. I'm just trying to reach out to straws and make some possible legislation in the future, or that's already set with the legislature of how that's allocated. That's kind of where my question is going.
Well, and I was on the Joint Budget Committee when I was a State House Representative for 4 years. that I didn't really understand the mission of the Unclaimed Property Program as well at that point. And we would see this $1 billion. We're like, hey, let's go supplement some of that need that we have at the state level or county level with these funds. The problem is this isn't tax revenue. This is actually people's money. And, you know, we want to get it back to them because it's their property. So what I tell the legislators, the Joint Budget Committee now is that if you do dip into it, the general fund is on the hook. If you spend that money and then we need it for claims, we're going to go pull it from the general fund to
and if it is claim, claim.
If it is. So we work pretty hard to it's tricky.
It's restricted funds.
Right, totally. But you know, if the legislature decided to change this and they said, no, we don't want to put this to agricultural, the returns on this, we want to put it back to counties for infrastructure upgrades or something like that. That's a bill that could be run to change that. So I'm not the policymaker in there. I'm just the one who actually does whatever they tell me to do. I do have friends in the legislature. We do suggest policy, but I can't actually vote on any of those.
I apologize.
Yeah, my wife is one of the legislators. Okay. So
I didn't mean to go down a rabbit hole. Okay,
well, you got me there, and then I had to mess up that my wife's in the legislature. So.
Well, now that you know someone on the other side, we can probably begin to draft language to, you know, one of the things that we mentioned early on, the unfunded mandates that we have at the county level. And even with some of the latest legislation that's passed in the last couple of years, the responsibilities for counties to continue to provide those services at the utmost quality that we know how and could. I mean, it's becoming pretty challenging to come up with some of the funds, but that might be, speak to Representative Young. If you can get a hold of her, please see what she would say there.
We try to look each other up every now and then. But let me give you an example of a program that I think might actually be of interest to you and speaks to that exact issue. So we know, and this isn't unique to Colorado, but we know the nation has a retirement savings problem. We have a lot of people who aren't saving for retirement, and as a result, when they retire, if they're only getting Social Security, it's not going to be sustainable. It's not enough. And in the state of Colorado, we discovered there are a million people here in the state of Colorado that work at a business that doesn't offer a retirement savings plan. They're at work. People are about 15 times more likely to save if they can do it through payroll deduction. And as a result, these folks aren't saving. But what happens if they aren't saving? And this is heartbreaking. I mean, somebody who contributes all the way through their working career, they're part of society, part of our communities, they're paying taxes and paying in Social Security, but they get to retirement age and they don't have enough to be sustainable in retirement. Two things happen. Either they have to keep working. We know a lot of these folks are people who worked at tough physical jobs that won't allow them to keep working. Their bodies just wore out. Or they retire and then they are needing safety net services, right? Because they have enough to be sustainable. So not only are they on Medicare, but they're on Medicaid. They're on SNAP. They're on, you know, housing supports, right? And those are all taxpayer-funded supports. So we actually did a study back in 2019, 2020, what I call the study of the cost of doing nothing. If we don't do something about helping this million people begin to save for retirement, what are the implications of that? And it turns out, over the next 15 years, it's an $18 billion tax bill to taxpayers to fund those safety net services above and beyond. Now, we're already seeing the shortfalls. Now, can you imagine what adding an additional load like that would be and taxpayers having to make hard decisions about it? Is this something we want to raise taxes to fund? But there was an easy solution to this. Let's find a way to get people to actually start to save. So we looked at some other states and we discovered that a few other states had implemented what's called an auto IRA opt-out program. So let me explain what that is. Auto means they're automatically enrolled. If the business doesn't have a retirement savings program, they're automatically enrolled in this one. And it's an IRA, a Roth IRA specifically, which is pretty appropriate for somebody with a moderate to low income type of job. And then it's opt out. So it's still voluntary for the employee. They don't have to do it, they can opt out. But we're using some behavioral economics to start them in the program and then letting them opt out instead of saying, well, make a decision whether or not you want to do this.
So who manages the portfolio?
So this is an interesting thing. Public-private partnerships. We actually passed the bill in 2020, and the Treasury, we've been looking to stand this up. I chair a board of eight additional people who are all retirement experts, and we're the fiduciaries of the program. So the businesses don't take on being a fiduciary. And we did RFPs, a whole procurement process to select a record keeper. That's Vestwell. So that's who transmits money out of payroll deduction, accounts for all of it, and then make sure every account is funded properly. And when the money is transmitted to the investment managers, that it's accurate. And then we have two investment managers, BlackRock and State Street, that actually invest that money to get better returns than what they would get if they were just putting it into a savings account. And so employees have 30 days. We've actually gone through a whole process of beginning to enroll employees. And once the business owner enrolls their employees have 30 days to decide whether or not they want to continue. They can opt out if they want. But the interesting thing is it's not tagged to the business. So this is not something the business owner has fiduciary responsibility for. My board is the fiduciary. The account is the employee. So if they move from one job to another, they just pick up on payroll deduction in the next place they go to if they don't have a retirement plan there.
So the business group would submit that and withholding and submit that to the state on their behalf.
Right. Yeah, the payroll, so just like they would on any other payroll taxes.
And there's no match for that. Really important.
Well, it's a lot of ERISA retirement plan. So a Roth IRA, there can't be a match there. Maybe Congress is going to change that. But, what we heard from small businesses was that it was just financially difficult, legally difficult, took a lot of time and resources, and they just were too busy. Just running the business to really try to figure this out. And then put them at a competitive disadvantage with the bigger businesses that could actually run a retirement program. Then they had trouble attracting and retaining employees because their compensation package wasn't as full as another business that had a retirement program. But now, takes about 20 minutes to,
what's it called? Or
the Colorado Secure Savings Program. And actually Colorado Secure Savings .com is where employers and employees go to. The employers use that with an access code to upload their payroll roster, and then the employees go in there to manage their account. So there's some defaults that are set up, but they can go in and they can, increase the deductions, decrease them. They can, make decisions about their own finances through that portal as well.
Great. What is the enrollment thus far? Do you have quite a few?
We're ramping up.
Yeah. I thought just stay up there.
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioners. To date, we have 89,000 businesses who have enrolled. We are waiting on some of those folks to run their first paycheck, the first payroll. So our secure savings team is working to make sure that payroll is being run. We have over 120 individual accounts. 120,000 individual accounts, including 431 individuals, sole proprietors, who decided to sign up for the program. And sometime this week, we will surpass $11 million.
So it's growing.
Are the dividends higher per se? And the reason I'm asking is for that employee who goes to the state program versus, say, an Edward Jones investment firm, is it a higher return for the employee, number one? Number two, is this not a conflict because you're in competition with the private sector?
Both good questions, and I think we're competitive as far as the fee structure and the returns. I think what happened was is that if you have an individual that goes and says, I want, you know, put in $100 a month, the fees on a small account like that in the private sector get to be pretty large. And so what happened is for decades, the financial services companies just weren't actually going after these accounts because it just wasn't financially lucrative for them to be able to do it. And if they did charge the fees to make it financially lucrative, it was just too big for, you know, the individual saver. So by pooling our savers, we're able to they're the ones with their fees that actually fund this. It's budget neutral for the state. But by pooling it, we're able to become very competitive that way. But what I told people is, my goal is not the program. My goal is the savers, right? I just want more savers because we've got this big $18 billion tax bill sitting out here if we don't do something about it. So I don't really care if they accumulate enough money in their Colorado Secure Savings Program account, and then all of a sudden they want to take it over to an Edward Jones or to a Vanguard or Fidelity. Now they have enough money in there, they can actually hit that mark with them and actually get a better deal. I'm fine as long as they continue to save.
And still be under the yield of the federal government tax on it because they're not in that threshold.
Well, there's limits, yeah.
The limits for the Roth area.
Yeah, Roth has lower limits.
I like that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to make sure that we actually get people on a better financial trajectory. Here's the other thing that we've done. We wrote into legislation that, in fact, we could partner with other states. So we began to have conversation with smaller states that don't have enough savers that would actually be able to launch this on their own. The fees would be too big, right? But if they partner with us, they get the same rate structure that we have. In fact, we wrote our contracts with the BlackRock and State Street that the more assets under management that we have, fees come down on that side. And so not only does it benefit these small states, but it also benefits our savers by getting a reduction on that side as well. And so we're about to ink a contract with Maine. They are ready to jump in with us. I think it's gonna happen in the next week or so. But we still gotta get New Mexico to pass. They have a retirement savings program, but it's an opt-in, not an opt-out. So in order to be able to be in on partnership with us, they have to change their statute to an opt-out. And if they do that, you know, we put a lot of wheels in motion with them, but we're having conversations with Nevada, Delaware, and other states around the nation that are small, but if they partner with us, we become a bigger critical mass of savers.
Yeah, the economy is going to scale, the portfolio grows, and then the distribution of those yields is going to benefit those members.
Right? Absolutely. And I'm sure you're holding it a medium risk investment platform.
Yeah, these are really targeted funds, essentially. I mean, we're
bonds and stuff.
Yeah, we have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that this grows for them in the best way possible.
Well, so, I'm glad you came today because I serve on another group. Los Angeles County and Ochoa County have an organization called Your Partners Incorporated Lending Mechanism for Small Businesses. This would be great for those loans we're giving out to small businesses to assist and attract and retain employees for the future.
Well, hold on to that thought because I have another program that I want to share with you as well.
One question is that there's states that have been doing this type of retirement savings for some time.
Right.
What's been your experience with them?
So the three that do an auto IRA opt-out program ahead of us were Oregon, Illinois, and California. Obviously, Illinois much bigger, California really big, Oregon about our size. The thing that we studied was the fact that Oregon and the state of Washington had two different types of programs that they launched at the same time back in 2017. So Oregon started the opt-out program that we have back in 2017. Washington started an opt-in program. So they created a website. people could go to the website and choose a retirement program and just start to save with that. And at the end of 3 years, the state of Washington had 300 savers that had voluntarily gone to the website and selected a plan and started to save. At the end of 3 years, Oregon had 60,000. So it's pretty clear to us, 300 versus 60,000, which one actually worked.
But what kind of, I guess, you know, those are the numbers of enrollees, but what kind of return are you supposed to get on investments? 2017 was what, 7 years ago, or 6 years
six
ago?
6 years ago, yeah. We can send you over there to their financials so you can go take a look at it. I haven't looked at it in a while, but you know, they all their returns and everything are public. It's called Oregon Saves, and you can actually go and take a look at their performance.
And who is handling their investments? Is it BlackRock and State Street?
I'm not sure who the fund managers are there.
I'll get that
information. We can find that out for you. Once we kind of got past the study part and kind of knew what we were doing, we've been so focused on just implementing our own program and setting up this partnership with other states is first through the nation. We're taking the lead on this to do this. So we've kind of been busy. And so I haven't been tracking, but we've got people, Georgetown Center for Retirement Initiatives is a partner at academic level that tracks a lot of this. They have a lot of information there, and there's a couple of financial advisors that specialize in this that put out a newsletter with all kinds of information about you know, how these funds are performing. So we can tap into that and give you that information. It's public. So Oregon and State Street, they have only one. Okay.
Any guess on the overhead? Is on that the overhead? To have them manage those accounts?
So again, you can go in. Okay. Yeah, you can go in. All this stuff is public. You can go in and research it. So
well, I kind of like this idea that the commissioner asked on the Zoom there. We have a lot of cattle ranchers and, you know, and agricultural ranchers in this community.
Right.
They're eligible for this as well, right?
They are. So just FYI, this is for businesses with five or more employees that don't offer a retirement program currently. But as Sheena said, you can opt in if you're less than five or sole proprietor. So we do have a requirement because we know that there's a lot of seasonal workers and this sort of thing. We do have to go through a know your customer process, and so we have you have to be employed by the same employer for 180 days or more. But there's some details in there that for eligibility that. Go in and look at our website and look at the FAQs to find out.
How do you promote? I mean, this sounds like an amazing opportunity for Coloradans. How are you promoting this opportunity?
Well, they're sending the treasurer out to talk about it.
You have an amazing PIO, so I think she can sing it out.
She's
there.
Doing that. And you know, I'm glad you said that because I agree with you. And we're actually doing really targeted marketing now. We actually are. We know which businesses actually have already have a retirement program. They have to file a federal form, and we have access to that. So we don't even reach out to those businesses. If we know they have a qualified retirement program, keep doing what you're doing. You don't have to worry about this. But if you don't have one, we know that we've been reaching out to businesses in a very targeted way. But we're also doing our marketing in that same targeted way, both with cable and digital outreach as well as email contacts. So
when we go to the five or more type businesses, our governments, government, county, cities, municipalities, able to join in as well and remove their current retirement they choose to do so.
Well, I'm a public employee. I'm actually a member of PARA, and I sit on the PARA board. So public employees have PARA. In some counties, you have your own retirement
system. CRA here.
Yeah, but I think like Boulder County is a member of PARA. So this is private sector workers, not public sector workers. I think there are retirement systems for them. But like I said, it's heartbreaking to find out that people work as good contributors to our communities end up in poverty in retirement. So we're really trying to target this group of people that are.
Even as county by commissioners, it's a recruitment issue here too for retirement. That's it. We've asked our administrator to look into the VRA program as well.
Sure.
We're just in the beginning phases of that and see if that would work across Amherst County because for exactly that reason of retaining and recruitment for long-term employees for a good retirement for the county government.
Absolutely.
Many years, county and city municipality governments don't have that in the smaller areas. I think it would be beneficial.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This conversation about a sustainability of retirement is really important. And we talked about the implications that people aren't, but you know, people go, well, this just sounds like a partisan thing. But the, do you know the Heritage Foundation? Have you ever heard of the Heritage Foundation? Mm-hmm. There was a guy by the name of David Johns, who's still there, who worked with a guy out of Brookings. So if you go the other side to the far left, and then you have the Heritage Foundation, the two of them, Mark Avery and Dick John, came together and said, this is not a partisan, conservative versus progressive. This is just an issue about how we help people, everybody, have a dignified, a sustainable retirement. So the seed of this thing came from two opposing polar opposites that came together and said, here's an idea that we think actually is going to help everybody.
To get politics out of it, usually a lot of good things come up.
Yeah, well, and I think this is the kind of stuff that treasurers across the country, not just me, look to. What are we doing in the long range that would actually have a positive impact on people over generations? So the legislature works in the media. You know, you're doing the daily grind with the things that absolutely have to get done in order to get government to work. But somebody ought to be kind of looking out to the future, two or three generations out, and say, what do we need to do now that will really pay dividends for us down the road? And treasurers are assuming that that role.
If in this fund, if a person passes before their fund is exhausted, is that thinking of generations out, does that those funds roll to their kinfolk?
Beneficiaries, exactly. Just like you would in para, you have to designate your beneficiary when you enroll. I mean, the same thing happens here. Right, we don't want it to come back as their property.
That's right.
Well, frankly, I will tell you, we're as national treasurers, we're actually, as we have more and more planned participants that are now in distribution mode, on mandatory distribution mode, and have moved, and those checks are bouncing back to these plans. The National Association of State Treasurers has come up with a clearinghouse so we can efficiently bring those checks in, locate the person, and return their mandatory retirement distribution to them. It's every level gets more complicated, doesn't it?
All this information is out on your website. So we, you know, these services are helpful me. So I think we need to promote those services.
Well, we want to get the word out about secure savings for sure. You know, Donna's going to help. We're working on the property tax deferral program. You and I talked about that, but that's something that has been of high interest because of what's happening with property taxes. But I want to come back to what you were talking about with businesses. We have a program called Climber. It's a $250 million small business loan program, $250 million small business loan program. And it launched right in the middle of the pandemic. So the governor and people in the financial services arena knew we needed to do something to help small businesses because we have a lot of small businesses, maybe more per capita in the state of Colorado than many other states. And so this is a backbone of our economy. We want to be sure that we support them. At the time we put all the pieces together on Climber, and by the way, Climber is an acronym, C-I-L-M-B-E-R. We had to go in a room for a long time to come up with enough words to actually make that acronym. I think it stands for Colorado Loans for Increasing Main Street Business Economic Recovery. That's C-L-I-M-B-E-R. But now the pandemic has passed, we're kind of looking at that R. It's not really recovery. We think maybe it might be more resiliency, but regardless, what happened early in the pandemic was, and we didn't know this was going to happen, we're offering below market rate interest rate loans for working capital and small businesses. And here comes the SBA and US Treasury with PPP program, right? And this isn't just below market rate. If you complied with all of the terms of PPP, you didn't have to pay back anything. You didn't have to pay back the interest or principal. So what happened was the market shifted away from Clymer back in 2021 when we first launched to PPP and EIDL and some of the other programs like that. But now that those programs have run their course, we've gone back and reformatted Clymer, and we're out marketing it as well and want to make sure that people are aware of it as an option as a small business owner. We don't take the applications in the treasury. That lending is done through local lenders and other organizations that want to take that on. Sometimes they're for-profit, sometimes they're nonprofit lenders or CDFIs. But
you're meeting with Janelle Burke tomorrow.
Some staff.
Yeah. Janelle Berry is our director of the OHR Department Incorporated. And we do not compete with the private sector. We're more of an alternate source.
Sure.
If you can't get traditional funding.
Yeah.
At 5%, 6% interest rates for these commercial loans, too. Would that this work for this climber be able to possibly pair up with these other loans? Now, the loans we're getting are CBDG grants and SBDC grants, and basically they're made to create jobs.
Uh-huh.
And then there's some paperwork, and then the interest we make, we can give that in revolving loans for other things that are required. Would this climber program be able to coexist with these grants that we're getting for loans as a subsidy if we can't get the entire funding for OPI?
Well, and the answer to that is I don't know, but we can find out.
Maybe yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or the answer is yes.
Okay.
Because all of that runs through CHAPA.
So yep. CHAPA is our loan program manager.
Okay.
They work directly with lenders on this. Like I said, we don't take the applications there, the local lenders do. And then CHAPA actually monitors that. But we do have some statutory requirements that we have to live within.
Right.
And so I that's why I said I'm not completely sure on that.
We'll pass on
to check. But here's what we discovered back in the Great Recession, that the lenders were reluctant to lend. Understandably, they were hanging on to their cash because they didn't know what was really going to happen. We kind of see that happening now again. And we're trying to incentivize lenders to, if they got a loan that was almost there, but they couldn't quite get over the finish line, how could we incentivize that loan? Could we do loan participation? Could we add credit reserve or cash collateral support or some other kind of direct lending that would actually move that lender over the finish line with that business? And the Treasury comes up with $50 million out of the $250 million. Again, this is a public-private partnership. Private sector contributory banks are contributing the $200 million. So Treasury brings $50 million of first loss capital, and then to get to lower interest rates, because we're taking on first loss, then the contributing banks have a much lower rate of return, which allows us to then offer these business loans at low market rate.
And
so we're happy to partner, whether we can really do it or not, that's an answer.
But the criteria for these loans are pretty much traditional banking criteria, or
the lenders are underwriting, so whatever they're doing with their underwriting process, we support.
We can let our local banks know of it, so no.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, just like secure savings, we're doing marketing, but I'm also out here talking these things up so people understand it's an option for them.
Well, as an agricultural county, our ranchers and farmers see this.
Yeah.
Now this would be another source to maybe keep them right here.
Yeah.
During the ups and downs.
Well, you know, I live in Weld County. I reside in Greeley, so I'm very familiar with the ups and downs.
The smell of the
smell. There's no smell.
We all know people.
Who told you that?
That is the smell of money and
yes, it is.
You're saying that the Treasury takes on the first loss, is that
right?
Right. So what's been your experience as using taxpayers' monies? That balance, the gain, the loss?
Yeah, well, we haven't had any defaults at this point. We haven't
had any defaults.
Well, since 2021, but again, the experience was pretty lean because PPP was in place. So, you know, we're kicking in now. One of the conditions that drove us back to the legislature to make some changes was originally the term of the loan would be no more than 5 years. So even though we had below market rate, we the monthly payments on a five-year loan were pretty high. And so businesses told us, you're gonna have to change that. So we changed that to up to a 10-year term, and we made some other changes as well. Listening to our lenders, listening to our businesses, we went back a couple of years ago, and so we've had a tranche that's already gone out, and we're just inked the deal for a second tranche of funding to go out under the new terms. And so we're marketing to make sure people are aware that now we have a new set of terms and a new level of excitement about Climber.
I'm in business. What kind of interest rate is charged?
The new interest rate is, the old one stuck in my head, and I'd have to go,
yeah, but I should have that on the top of my head.
My mistake.
Prime plus 1%, 2%?
No, it's below market rate. It's a little bit below, and depending on who's doing well, a little bit above, depending on the there's a range. The old ones were 2.6 to 3.9, depending on who the lender was. But that was when when interest rates were low, but still below market rate. But the contributing banks were asking for 2% at that point. Now they're asking for 2.5. So essentially, you could add about 0.5% on to the 2.6, 3.9. It's a little bit higher than that, but
it's under 6%.
Awesome. Yeah, it's under 6%.
Which is under commercial rate right now, which is under 1%.
Well, and that's the goal. We initially had people tell us we're going to have to offer this at double-digit interest rates. That can't pass a smell test with me. I can't look at a business owner and say, we're giving you a double-digit interest rate. So we had to come up with a new process.
That's how used cars.
Yeah.
So have the underwriters that rejected some of these, and now that you've gone to a 10-year repayment amortization plan, do you know if anyone has been rejected, or is there a cap on the maximum amount of the borrowing?
Well, it's 10,000 to 500,000 is the range. Here's what we don't have a portal that every business goes through to start the process. We have people to work with them, like Apex. Danny Martinez at Apex does technical assistance, and so we do get some contact through our website. People do approach us, but essentially, a lot of businesses just end up going to their local lender and saying, I want a Climber loan. And it may or may not be the right thing for them. We may never even hear that the bank said, oh, we think, or that, the lender might be a CDFI, might be a credit union. They may say, we have a different, program that we think might fit better. So we don't know, if they were rejected or not under something like that. We just don't get that kind of information. But
it's a tool available for
it. It's a tool. It's a tool available. Yeah.
I apologize for the show here. Are those terms, are the interest rates typically fixed or variable? I don't know. I'm getting out of the
reason. Yeah, typically fixed. I should be able to go back and give you the exact numbers, because we just had a Climber board meeting like a week and a half ago where we set those rates, and I can't believe I didn't
That's get fine, but they're technically fixed for a 10-year term.
Up to 10-year term. Yeah, the business can decide. Before, it was up to 5.
Right.
It was pretty challenging to get up to 10. And
I was starting over, I line up with this.
Yeah, well, and this is not for, people say, well, I have a startup that I want financing for. This is for businesses that have been in operation. So we're just trying to help them with that resilience.
I don't want any more debt.
we work, actually, OEDIT, the Office of Economic Development and International Trade, is a partner with us. And actually, the chair or the head of the Minority Business Office is a member of the Climber Board that I chair. And so they're great partners with us, along with CHAPA. And, OEDIT's got like 162 different programs for businesses, almost too many, And so if Climber's not the right one, OEDIT's probably got one out there. We just have to find a way to help businesses navigate to get the right one that they need.
So in years past, SBA has been traditionally a source for small businesses to borrow. But traditionally, it's always been jumping through hoops to get them approved.
Right.
Is this similar or this less cumbersome getting a for this lead liner? Again, is it just based on the lender?
Yeah, it's really based on the requirements of the lender. So what we know is, and this is why the technical assistance becomes really helpful, because and this happened during PPP. You know, you saw a lot of really small businesses that didn't get PPP loans because they didn't have a banking relationship already with their lender. And as a result, particularly the way the fee structure was set up and tilted towards larger businesses and just the amount of work that it would take to qualify and know your customer process for PPP, it just persuaded banks to really lean towards larger loans and existing customers. And so a lot of small businesses were left out of the loop on PPP, but eventually they figured out a way to get in. Most of them found some avenue in there, but we think if we can, you know, we get this feedback from the lenders all the time. They go, when somebody comes in, they go, we don't have time to handhold them through an entire process if they've never been banked before. So we're working on the technical assistance side to see if we can come up with resources to help them understand, you know, is this the right program for you? What are the eligible uses? Do you qualify? And what financials do you have to put together so that when you walk in the door to your lender, you have all that information there, you're ready to go. You're not, it's not like a cold call and really time consuming for that. So,
and then when you go to the website, they have a frequently asked question, kind of a guide process.
They do. I think they need to work on it a little bit more.
They do.
Yeah, I keep talking that they actually need to have case managers that know the whole field of all the different programs. And when somebody comes in and says, I need help this way, they already know in their head the 5 or 6 or 3 or 4 programs that might be the best bet for them.
And the feedback was given to them. I attended one of the meetings, and what I said to them, it's really good that those of us that know the system and the process behind, we think that everyone is going to understand this. So they do need to work on that to make it understandable to the first borrower, you know, the first time a borrower, because it gets pretty complex. And then the underwriter is going to be asking for additional information. So if there was a tutorial in there to walk and to go through the process, I mean, that would be really beneficial for first time borrowers.
Well, I think so, and I think even more than that. I mean, it's still time consuming for a small business owner to even go through a tutorial when they're strapped with so many different things that they have to do that are so immediate. You know, it's.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. And so to have somebody that's actually just say, out of the 162 programs, here are a few that you should go investigate and we'll help you with that. That's going to take some resources. We're working cooperatively with them to see if we can help them. Sarah, go ahead.
A couple of questions. Has the Treasurer's Office had to add additional staff to manage these programs?
We have, yeah. We
and their salaries are paid out of your general funds, I guess we'll call it, or do they come out of these programs? Or?
Right. So, we have one person that is the program manager for Clymer, and the tax credit sales that we have done to actually raise the state, the Treasury's part of 15 million funds that salary along with Mark of the contract that we have with Chapel. So that's life insurance premium tax credits, essentially. Which is very stable. It's actually been around longer than income tax in the state of Colorado. So we actually, during the economic downturn in 2020, couldn't walk in and ask for startup money. So we borrowed money from the future tax credit sales, brought it into the present to run the program. So it is eventually revenue that would have come in 25, 26 that we brought in and utilized. So. Essentially, that is general fund money, but it was a conscious decision by the legislature to run the bill to find the funding source that way. So that's what they chose to do with it, because we were cutting, the state was cutting the budget by $3.3 billion. It was a 22% cut. So me walking in with an ask of 50 million, when they're cutting their budget by 3.3 billion, it's just a lot harder.
You didn't mobilize those revenues.
Right.
In the future.
Exactly right. But we do know that if we keep businesses alive, they'll pay taxes
in the economy.
If a business shutters and they fire their employees, you've lost revenue as a state, you've lost that cohesiveness of the state. So it's a balance of economic opportunity loss versus.
So it's a risk.
Yeah, it's a calculated risk, is what it is.
What about the Colorado Secure Savings that also?
We had some startup money from the state to get that started, but that will be paid back. And the savings themselves pay the fees to run the program. So the private sector partners that we have, all that comes from savers. This is budget neutral for the state. We have 4 employees. We're about to bring on a 5th one to run that program. It's pretty lean when you think about how big that program is. To have 4 employees to launch a program of that size. I'm very impressed with our team and what they've done. But that's all budget neutral for the state.
One of these days you will have what those salaries and everything else are. I guess I'll go back to my question sometime back, the entire overhead programs. So the state overhead plus Blackrock and State Streets fees, et cetera, on these retirement.
Yeah, but they're
so
those fees are the ones the savers pay, not the state pays.
That's right, but the fees are also the savers, if I understood you correctly, the savers are also paying for the 4 additional staff.
Right. Right. To avoid an $18 billion tax liability. Sounds like a good investment to me.
I'm not arguing whether or not it's a good goal.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to.
Yeah. Well, it's a balancing of risks. So if we ignore it and we don't address it, we have a known $18 billion tax liability. So if we launch this program, essentially with a pretty lean staff, that investment is small compared to the liability on the other side of the budget.
And as a person is. Potentially could be put into this savings program, and it would be beneficial to me as a corporate investor to know what the overheads will be at the state level, and
right.
What the fees will be at the private
sector. Right. Okay. And so we, just like we were kind of pointing to Oregon, Colorado Secure Savings Program, ColoradoSecureSavings.com, that website, has an FAQ section, and you can actually go in and find out all the information public gets available.
And creating the compact would obviously decrease the expense. Let me ask, what about elections come, elections go, and we tend to just move on. Those are in statute. All these programs are written in statute. So
right.
The next treasurer that comes around says, you know, I just don't like this program. They cannot, of their own volition, just pretty much do all over the program.
Exactly. Well, there's nothing worse that you can do to get people who've never saved for retirement before, and then you get them started and then pull the rug out from underneath them on something like this. There has to be sustainability way out of the
country.
And so, you know, we voted the statute in case legislators started looking at that money going, oh, well, you've got a bunch of assets under management. Can we tap into that? And that's not state money. That is savers' money. It's a big firewall there between the state and the program so that you know, this can't be tapped into. So the governor appoints the members of the board. The treasurer is automatically on the board as the chair, but got not neither of the people on that board. And frankly, we're all dedicated to making sure that this thing works well. But I, you know, nothing is immune from elections. I guess, you know, you get a governor with a different idea that didn't want to appoint people that were friendly to the program. Could happen, but I don't think that's going to happen. This is really something that helps everybody. It doesn't matter what zip code you're in, doesn't matter what, you know, what party or not that you're affiliated with. this is a program for everybody. And I just really doubt that an election is actually going to have an impact on a program that's this well-intentioned.
So these two programs sound like they're really good and solid and moving forward and you know, set in stone and have plenty of documentation for us to go review as for the general public to see the success rate of other states that have done so.
And just like all of you, we have public notice board meetings and we always invite the public to come on. As a matter of fact, Secure Savings gets a pretty big national audience every time we have a meeting. We get people, because we do them by Zoom, we get people all over the country that are waiting in. And so we're following open meeting law. We notice those meetings. We invite the public to give public comment during the public comment section. So as the program evolves, if people have ideas, we're always open to hearing from those. Same with climate. We do the same thing there. We have a board leadership in both chambers and the governor gets to appoint members to that board as well. So,
well, it seems like a very solid program, and it's great. I don't like to talk about what ifs, but I'm going to, since you're here. The big what if Proposition HH gets on the ballot. And could you give us a little bit of insight of the pros and cons when it passes or fails?
Well, I specifically tended to back out of that conversation because it was a lawsuit. And you know, who knows what's going to happen. I think you were all at CCI in Vail. I don't know if you attended that session. We talked about the property tax deferral program as a small piece of that property tax situation. I thought Jenny Pinchino did a great job going through the pros and the cons of HH.
Right.
And I think the big aha I got out of the session was all of you and other taxing entities like school districts and others saying, well, we're having to come up with a few different budgets depending on what happens with WASU, what happens with HH, and you know how mills are set in our different taxing entities within the county. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. We know we have a problem. We're not sure if it's the right solution, but we know people's interest is heightened. Rightfully or wrongly, I've been telling people, you should read your property tax bill a little bit more carefully and see what all the different taxing districts are on that bill. And you know, each one of them has a board, and each one of them is actually going to set the mills. And some of them may need to keep the mills at the same level they were the year before, but some of them might be encouraged to reduce their mills now that the, what was the bill number?
Senate Bill 23-108.
108. So Senate Bill 108 passed. You know, they can lower mills and then don't have to go back to a vote of people to increase them should they need to. But, you know, this is a conversation with the voters, with the taxpayers, and the elected officials at each one of these levels to say, prove to us that you need this revenue. And it very well may be justified. I know school districts that are dramatically underfunded and may need that revenue, but other taxing districts may be in better shape and may be in a position to lower that. So whether HH passes or not, this is a good civics lesson for everybody to say this is more system involvement in your processes at the county level.
And it's got to come out of the litigation that is currently for us from the county perspective. Senate Bill 108 was the solution, at least from where we stood. 303 became basically, it overpowered 108. And 303 actually gave the mandates to foment the advancement of HH and Prop HH, which right now we don't know. And again, this is gonna be up to the Supreme Court to say,
right,
he goes or he doesn't. But I think the question that we have had here at the county level, it creates for us, small counties, our finance director is having to look to at the very least, two different scenarios.
Right.
At the very least. And depending on what its cumulative language, that later on may dictate or mandate some other,
right,
we just never know. But
and I have a strong appreciation of that, having spent 4 years on the Joint Budget Committee, how much work the staff has to put in to come up with one scenario. let alone multiple ones, right?
And see, and thereby, Mr. Treasurer, is those are the unfunded mandates that we are speaking of from counties, because now we are putting a whole lot more work on our staff, mm-hmm. and in various offices, the assessor, the finance,
right,
the treasurer, and those, whether we call them unfunded mandates or not, that's money that we have to pay out, mm-hmm. either on overtime, additional FTEs, whatever the case may be. And so those are the challenges that are going to
be. There's the start for this is not government. The start for this is market forces, right?
Sure.
So I think that sometimes people forget that they get this, big increase in their AV, and I'm like, who said this is what it is? Well, actually, that's market forces. I mean, you can protest that, go through a process and have them evaluated in the assessor's office and confirm or reject that it's a market price. But at the end of the day, it was really market forces that generated this to begin with. And, we constantly in state treasury and in Donna's office and the county treasurer are responding to economic forces just like you do, that are really not in our control, but we're challenged to, with the staff we have, address what's happening with current events. And so, whether you agree or not, can I put one plug in for one thing in HH that I kind of like?
Sure.
It does make the homestead exemption portable, which has been a problem in the past. Now, I'm not talking about the deferral program that we were discussing earlier, but
our senior's exemption.
Yeah,
that was almost taken away.
So they had to be in
there. During COVID, I remember that we fought that one hard.
They had to be in their house for 10 years or more, right. And if they move out of that, then that program doesn't transfer with
Was it improper? Is it transferring now with HH?
If they change it, then transfers once they qualify, and they downsize or they move to some other property. That exemption just comes back.
So the issue that I have too, some of these things with HH is the history of Los Angeles County. And not all counties are identical. So when you have legislation put under the Gold Dome, it affects everybody differently. So just a quick brief history. 8 years ago, this county was broke. We were closed 2 days a week and unemployment furlough. We had a cap of a 9.375 million, which we still have. And we had no other revenue coming into the table. We weren't de-bruised. We came forward, all the officials came forward with a sales tax, and one cent sales tax and a half cent sales tax, and we measure all at once. Mm-hmm. We proved them all by 70% because of that.
So, congratulations.
We just barely got out of the woods, thank you. And then a couple years ago, we went for the excess funds, so we were restricted, and we got that approved as well. Mm-hmm. Taxpayers, but what my concern is with HH and our property taxes dropping, the level of rates, the ARA's assessment rates going down, and knowing then all of that is for naught, because we're going to see, even though the assessed valuations have gone up and the revenue's gone up, 20 years from now, when none of us are here in this room, goes up, comes down, especially in a small community, well, where is the county going to be at that point with this implementation of this law if it takes effect? So that's my. I'm looking 20 years down the road, that what took 20 years to get to that thing 7 years ago, 8 years ago, before we went home, and had some ballot measures that didn't pass right now. There were some legal things at the time. So as a county commissioner, that's my thought process of sustainability of revenue sources for the future of the staff, for the folks that need to have that PERA or their retirement account. And a decent salary to retain employment in the county. So that's kind of a big back of my brain that I.
Well, it should be.
It was horrible. It was so bad. Matter of fact, it was so bad that some of our exhibitions were giving part of salaries back to keep staff working.
Right.
I personally didn't take the county health insurance for 2 years to save the county over $8,000 a year, which is sacrifices.
Right.
Sacrifices that our staff did and Donna's crew. And before Kerry was here and all of our officials, they sacrificed because of revenue losses. And if this takes place, are we going to go down that same hole for Los Angeles County and small counties again? That's a concern.
Yeah, other counties are going to suffer as well.
Right. So that's a big concern we have.
So the question is, and my understanding is HH doesn't ask that there's probably a 30% a tax increase anyway. Is that big?
It depends on the assessed valuations, right? And we haven't got the valuations from our assessor. She's not on all the way, but
I'm just saying, forecasting out in the future is a wise move, and it's good to be thinking about that. I talked about that earlier. That this is something as a treasurer that I care about. I think what happens though is that we, and Chair and I talked about this earlier, we tend to look at tax in silos. We don't look at the entire tax policy of the state, both not just property tax, but income tax, sales tax, or the big three. And we tend to do those things in isolation. So we make a change to property tax, or the voters vote in a decrease in income tax, and then it's a balloon. It just kind of shoves out in the other areas, and all of a sudden we've got problems with property tax or sales tax because we decreased income tax. There's a certain amount of money that it takes to actually run government. That's the debate that goes on every year at the county level. It's the debate that goes on with the JVC and the legislature at the state level. Congress does it as well. But, we've been on a defunding track for about 30 years in the state of Colorado. And I spent a career in education. We now have the lowest competitive salaries for teachers in the country when adjusted for inflation. We're below Mississippi. We pay dismal salaries for teachers. And as a result, they're fleeing the state. We have a lot of vacancies, which does not help us actually deliver a good educational program. So I think we're going to have some honest and rational conversations about rational tax policy that we need to have in order to provide sufficient revenue so that we don't find ourselves in this up and down yo-yo.
And maybe be a regional issue and not a state initiative, because not every county is the same. You know, the Boulder and Denver County may be very well populated, very well funded, and the salaries are very nice, but you get out here in Otero County, Los Angeles County, Webernal County, and the region that we represent here with our constituents is totally different.
You might be surprised if you spend a little time in Boulder County. There's a lot of people that are at very low levels of income in Boulder County. Yeah, the city of Boulder, maybe a different story, but the county.
Outside the
county. Yeah, different story. And, you know, we see this. The thing I try to tell people, having lived, you know, I'm the only statewide official that doesn't live in the Denver Boulder area. I'm more sensitive to these rural issues than others. And having spent time in Denver, it's remarkable how everybody's experiencing the same things, but things the other people aren't. But they all are, everybody's experiencing some pretty significant challenges.
I think at the end of it, you know, it's going to be interesting what comes out of the Supreme Court. But my concern and my comment on the proposition of change is if we're going to be using the senior exemption as a way, as a hook, then we're doing away with Tabor, which to a certain extent, I wanted to see a single subject proposition. And I think that's what the, personally, that's what I would like to see. And that's kind of what the majority of Colorado counties, pretty much the way we would have liked to see. We saw 108, and in fact, we went and testified on 108. We liked that because it gave the authority back to the counties. Rather than the state coming in and saying, you know what, let me help you step out of the way. Then here comes, and of course, we got the big property, the land use bill that we were able to update on the 11th hour as well. Kind of let us run the counties. And I think HH, it's such an interesting proposal that if this passes, we're going to be setting, if it comes out of the Supreme Court, then the precedent of constitution and statute being superseded by an opinion that's going to be a legal opinion. But, you know, we can debate all that all day long here. It has some good aspects, but I think in the majority, a single subject is what we would like to see from the perspective of small communities and small counties. So, but I know you, we don't want to belabor that point. And one of the perspectives that we were speaking with the treasurer, Leonetti, as well, was the property tax deferment that you are talking about. So why do you extrapolate on that?
Sure. And again, this is, of all the programs, probably the narrowest of implications, but one that actually has big implications for staffing. this program has been in effect. It's not the homestead exemption. We're not exempting people from paying taxes. We're allowing them to defer. They still have to pay it back with interest, but if they're in a really tough financial situation that where they might lose their home, or maybe they're making decisions about not eating and taking the medicines, and instead they're paying your property tax. It's like, well, wait a minute, maybe this is a safety valve for you that gets you through a tough financial situation. When I came into office, it was only available to seniors and to active military, and we only had about 400 participants in the program statewide. So not heavily used, but it was very labor intensive. The process started at the county level because the property had deep qualifications that, you know, this is gonna be a lien on the property. So we needed to know that the title would allow that. There was room on the title for that. And they weren't over leveraged, and that they actually owned the property. I mean, none of this means that we could do in our office. And so this was a very paper-based process, very labor intensive for the county treasurer, the assessor, and a clerk and recorder to start the process. And then a big pile of paper will come to the one employee we had at the treasury that was managing this. And I thought, wow, all of this for 400 people, this is, you know, this is a lot of work that and a lot of paper. Can we do this better? And then we have people who are coming to us saying, you're not marketing this well enough. We need to have it go out further. So I started to work with the County Treasurer's Association to see if we could come up with a better solution. But in the meantime, the legislature came in and said, because they began to see property values increasing and they knew people were going to get worried about massive increases in property tax, they said, let's let other people access the deferral program, not just seniors and active military. Let's open it up to all property taxpayers who qualify. And so we did a study and discovered that actually, we didn't do it. A company called CoreLogic did the study, and they said this program could grow from 400 you have to 35,000 under the way the legislature is envisioning this. And now I knew for sure we weren't equipped either at the county level or the state level to staff this and talk about unfunded mandate. This was going to be a non-operational program because we just didn't have the staff to allow it. So, we went back to the legislature and said, if you want to do this, this is what we need. There was a second bill that allowed us to actually implement a technology solution that works really, really well. And it's not up there right now, but you can go to colorado.propertytaxdeferral.com in January when you get your property tax bill, and you can actually select, am I going for the senior program, the active military program, or what we call the growth cap program, this is the rest of the property taxpayers, and see if you qualify. There's a political reporter here in Colorado. Last time in January that we ran the program under this model the first time, who went there and said it was the best run portal any state government had ever seen. So I know we've got the right technology solution, but there are a lot of facets to the finances behind this that are still under debate. So I asked the treasurer, Nanetti, to give me information about what additional needs that she may have. As you start to investigate this, you may see things that none of the rest of us do, and we need to run additional legislation to make sure it really works well. We'll do that. But again, it's a safety valve program. It's not something that we think everybody should use, but we do want everybody to take a look at it, and if they think they're in that big a financial bind, it's a safety valve that would keep them from worse financial
trouble. Well, does it tack on to say for this deferral, 2 years down the road, they still can't do it? Are they eligible again for another deferral? And how long is that before the treasurer's office can go after for a tax sale to collect it back for the county and for the taxing districts that are not getting their funding?
The seniors.
Or do you reimburse it immediately and then that property owner owns the state?
Right. Okay. Property owner owns the state. We know you have to make budget.
Okay.
Right. It's the same with the exemption program. You know, we back
just like
that
the senior exemption
as well, because you need that revenue in order to function. So this is a decision by legislature and the Joint Budget Committee of how much money they want to spend on these programs to backfill. And so they've done that. Now, seniors can defer all of their property tax, and they can do it year after year after year. Some do in parts of the state, and they let their estate settle after they pass away. They just settle it up that way. Some just do it for a year and then pay it back. It's a simple interest loan. So whatever the 10-year treasury is on February 1st is the interest rate that will be applied to the lien. And then if they decide to do it another year, then you know February 1st that next year is when that interest on that part of it is assessed. On the senior and active military, it's kind of unlimited. There's a cap of deferring up to $10,000 on the expansion group period of the time. Right. So they have to experience a 4% growth in property tax, and they can't defer more than $10,000 total.
And then the state will determine a certain point in time where this money will not get paid back, and then you take action.
Yeah, and that's my comment maybe generally on some of the other things we were talking about on HH, and that is, you know, every time the legislature comes together, every time the Joint Budget Committee does their analysis, they're looking at the implications of these things, and they may run legislation to adjust whatever might pass on some kind of initiative to, because what we knew then doesn't work now. Unless it's in the Constitution, it changes in the Constitution, they can run statutory changes to do that. Same thing here, I think, you know, as this program takes off and we see how much is being deferred, if that's beyond the limits of the general fund to support, they're going to have to make decisions as a Joint Budget Committee and as a legislature how to scale that back to fit within the budget. That's not a decision that I am asked to make anymore. It was when I was a legislator, but not now as treasurer. My job is to implement the program, and we're doing it as best we can.
And we spoke a little bit about this earlier, and I asked you the question, what happens to 35,000 people just do some marketing on the very own and they advertise the program, and this we have 135,000. On the legislation that was passed, is there a cap to the number, and then the appropriations that would be needed when I asked the question about the fiscal note, that fiscal note, 35,000 is right. Going to be, the appropriation has to be able to meet that for consecutive years. Mm-hmm. And what happens, at what point in time do we tell that 35,001, sorry, you got to go home, there is no more money. Because at the end of the day, this is for the benefit of Coloradans that are not able to meet their debt yet. The state is going to be carrying, once again, kind of putting it back on the way Mr. Dorn Camp kind of created the scenario, is the taxpayers creating the funding without other taxpayers, right? That is the, but then why only 35,000 and not me that I'm on the maybe 150,000 brackets. So,
right.
And again, I think that's going to be the conversation that needs to go on. And I'm really glad that it went from a study to a bill. We need more legislation like that, from a study to see if indeed it makes sense.
Right.
And the allocation and the appropriation is going to be there. Now, the market, the economy will stabilize or take a downturn, and this program is going to be one of the first ones to go away.
At a time where it's probably most needed,
right?
Exactly.
Correct.
Yeah. Which is the story of government, writ
right.
large, unfortunately. But you know, it's an annual decision, and the interesting thing that I think sometimes the general public does not understand is that no general assembly can commit a future general
right.
assembly to a future appropriation.
Sure.
Now there are some things that we know that we don't fund. Like our repayment, our debt service on COPs that would ruin our ability to finance capital construction here in the state of Colorado if we didn't make the debt service. So even though they're not obligated each year to make that debt service, I think there's an understanding that if we didn't do it, that the implications would be dramatic. the same thing here. You know, we've made our best guess as to how many people we think are going to access this, but at the end of the day, it's risk management. I mean, how much will the budget withstand? As Coberly has to go through this process with you, budget-wise, you know, kind of assess, you know, we have programs, but, you know, can we afford them within the county? And if we expand them, then there's too much risk. What do we do there?
We do the same thing as commissioners. Yeah. Don't come in future commissioners of debt and,
right,
you know, expenditures that we can't cover now. So, like, especially in our contracts and stuff like that, we're going to afford it.
Yeah,
all of our bigger contracts.
So those initiatives that are passed or bills that are passed that have statutory implication can be revisited by the legislature and amended. If it's constitutional, and some parts of HH are constitutional, then the voters have to act on that. But you know, anything that's statutory certainly could a future generation, a legislature. And when I was on JVC, we used to run tons of bills as JVC bills, because we knew we needed to adjust things to make sure they work well going on for the future. So we constantly were making iterative changes to the legislature, to the statutes, to make sure that it worked.
So in doing the calculation for the 35,000 was there, we use an algorithm to kind of calculate the could be expense for this 35,000,
right?
And having that, now you have kind of a median average expense for the state of Colorado, and then of course we determine for that constituent. And having that, then I think then the mathematical calculation, once you have the algorithm, the mathematical calculation, you can put $1 million in there and times $1 million, right? If you think that the average property tax deferment is going to be A. But again, so I think
it depends on who is deferring.
Again, well, correct.
Because if it's seniors, they can defer all of their property tax in perpetuity to the end of their life if they choose to.
But the appropriation.
But the expansion group, the growth group, can only defer up to 10,000. So there is limits there built into the statute.
10,000 up to multiple years, and then there's.
Yeah, they can defer multiple years, but once they hit 10,000, sure, deferment, they can defer.
To me, I guess the challenge is, how do you tell some Colorado's you're eligible for that?
And again, like I said, I think, you know, if more seniors start to do this, and they start to do it across the state, and they do it year after year after year, that's actually a bigger tax implication or backfilling.
And let me ask you that the one question for us as county commissioners. So when it comes to closing that transaction and for the county to begin to help the state to collect that debt, that deferment, Ms. Leonetti here, one member, it's gonna need additional help. Are those costs gonna be reimbursed by the state to the county for the execution of that collection?
Well, we're actually, this was a decision, and we worked pretty closely with the County Treasurers Association during the years when they were actually running these bills to make sure that we came up with a solution here, because it had been something that was handled by each individual county and very labor intensive. And the consensus decision was we should lift this up out of the counties because it's too labor intensive. Too staffing is too difficult to forecast. We should lift it up out of the state or out of the counties and centralize it at the state and bring in a third-party firm who would actually implement a technology solution to make the process more streamlined. So, you know, that was something that, you know, was hotly debated 2 years ago, last June in Grand Junction, and then everybody came back together 2 years ago in October in Greeley, and everybody came together and said, yeah, we think this is a better way to do it. So that doesn't mean that we've completely eliminated staffing needs at the county level, depending on what happens. We're beginning to hear from our treasurers and our clerk and reporters and assessors. There's things that we have envisioned that we may have to go back to the legislature and ask for additional support. But that's why I'm out here listening and making sure we're clear on what's happening so that we can deliver that message.
I think the legislature program seems to me, in layman terms for the folks, is a safety net. Hopefully we have it and don't need it.
Exactly,
and,
right.
And
again, I said safety valve, but safety net.
If we promote it, then you're going to have more folks utilizing it. So I don't know if that's something like the other programs we would want to be advertising or advocating for. Hey, don't pay attention. Come to my number, do this for the rest of your life, and all that. And a lot of our seniors wouldn't want to do that either.
Right.
They have the sense of pride and so forth. But,
well, but if they're not eating and they're not taking.
Exactly. I mean, they're adapted.
Riches. Like, wait a minute, let's
take that position. And I think that is a great tool for our treasurer's office to facilitate with it.
So the biggest problem we have right now is people don't know the difference between the exemption program and the deferral. So they want the exemption program that they go over and start the process on the deferral website. And so what we're really working with the treasurers is property tax bills go out. Let's have consistent information that goes out about both programs. It clearly helps taxpayers understand what each program does so they can make a good decision as to whether or not they want to be in one or the other or both. So a senior could be in both the deferral program and the exemption program.
And I was going to ask you that if someone goes into the wrong portal, is there a way that somehow the system detects you're in the right building or the wrong room?
Yeah, not easily. We discovered in the last round. So what happened was 2 years ago, we had 400 people. And then last year, that when we implemented this, it grew to 1,000. That's because people hadn't gotten big increases in their AV yet, right? But there was some growth, and we began to find some of these little kinks that we needed to work out. And we found some pretty labor-intensive processes where somebody had gone all the way down the pathway and was just about to lock in the deferral, and then all of a sudden at the last minute went, oh no, I wanted the exemption, and we had to undo a lot of work. And so there's some staff issues here, staffing issues that we've got to address and figure out better streamlined processes.
Is there some information that you can pass on to our treasurer's office so it's readily available for her to hand out?
That's why Sheena's here.
At your expense, not the county.
We're producing that. That was awesome. We're trying to help.
Lots of great news and lots of information for me.
Yeah, well, and you know, I mean, we just scratched the surface on some of these.
We had
pretty in-depth conversations, but we're always happy to, you know, get additional comments or questions. You know, we're leaving contact information and really do want you to reach out. And if you have, if you're like me, it's like half an hour after the meeting's over, and I have another brilliant question that you want to get answered. So
biggest concern.
And you don't have to twist my arm to come to Los Angeles County.
Well, thanks for coming.
But I'm happy to come here. So if you want to invite me back, I'm always happy to.
The pains that our county staff had to go through 8 years ago, it's very fresh in our memory still.
Sure.
And so that's why I advocate so hard and what we try to do here. And when we see stuff like this at the state legislature and how it affects us. So, you know, if you hear me chiming in here, then that's the reason why. For the folks that elect me to office and represent them.
Absolutely. And when you're talking about doing a study, I when I was in the legislature, I had bills, and people who wanted to kill the bill would turn it into a study bill, and then it would just kind of, it never went anywhere. And so when we were looking at secure savings, they said, we think it really should start as a study bill. And I went, But now I'm really glad that we did that, because we really got valuable information that helped us make good decisions to implement. And we did the same thing now with the property tax deferral program. And if the commitment is there to actually follow through and actually implement based on what the study produces, then I think, you know,
it's an easier sales pitch. You have something tangible to look at, read, do, watch, touch, feel, smell, all nine yards.
Right. Yeah. And on its face, deferment, it implies something else for us at the county level, like we're going to be deferring taxes, we're going to have the revenue. But thank you so much for the clarification that the state is actually willing to stand behind this whole thing, and we appreciate that. And a ton of information. Commissioner Tony Hass, do you have any comments? Any questions? Well,
this has been very, very informational. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Appreciate hanging in there with me. I think sometimes being the one person in the hybrid mode there online makes it a little tougher to track. I hope you've been able to hear everything that we've been saying.
Oh, yeah, and I've taken a plethora of notes, let me tell you, so.
Well, we'll leave you contact information, too, and the same goes for you. As long as you reach out if you have additional questions or ideas or comments.
So I think I'll be talking to you tomorrow on the Action 22 call, too.
Ah, okay, yeah.
All right.
22. Absolutely, sounds good.
Very good. So I hope you're going to be spending a little time in Trinidad. And if you're not, we want to look at the traffic jam that you're going to be facing tonight here in the San Luis County, right? You might be delayed a minute with all the construction that we have around here, but nothing like Denver.
I guarantee you that's the case.
So thank you so much.
We're going to stay in Pueblo. We're meeting with Pueblo folks tomorrow and up to Colorado Springs the day after that. But I'm back around the state all the time. I love the state. No matter where you go, what direction you go.
Beautiful.
We do have a huge festival, music festival, Labor Day weekend at Monument Lake Resort, the Caveman Festival. Looking to come down and join us for the weekend.
All right. Yeah. If I can get my staff to put that on my calendar.
It's already there.
You know, I'm 5 minutes ahead of my calendar.
Well, I'm sure I can
go, that's where I go.
I'm sure I can secure you a ticket or two.
You're 5 minutes ahead of schedule?
I'm behind schedule right now. I talk to my
well. If you have no additional comments, commissioners, no other questions, I'm going to entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second the motion.
Mr. Hess?
Yes.
Mr. Wiesel?
Yes.
Mr. Wiesel?
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
See ya.